Good evening.
Good evening.
Lee, do you know everybody here? Should we do introductions around?
I'm Donald Ben. Randy.
Dan.
Britt.
Carolyn.
And what we're studying is the ox herding pictures. Based on John Dido Laurie's interpretation. We talked about the first one last week. Searching for the ox. And the next one is called Finding Traces of the Ox. And it led me to remember the first times that I started getting little messages from the world about the Dharma. In a coherent form. I spent my teenage years reading philosophy. I read Plato and Aristotle and Kant and Spinoza and everything I could get my hands on, trying to understand how things were. And when I went to college, my mother sent me a book, a little paperback book by, she said, by Dr. Alan Watts. And wow, it was a real revelation. After all those other words, these words cut right through. I don't even know which one it was, but he had just begun to speak about Zen, and it made such a difference. Even though I didn't know what he was talking about, I really didn't, but I felt it. And I think we've all had that experience of getting a glimpse that there's something there. You can feel it. When I had children, I had them close together, so there was a point where there was a house full of little boys running around. And KPFA used to play Krishnamurti every single day. They had a lecture by him every single day. And it was the same feeling. And I didn't quite know what he was talking about. I'm not sure I still do. But I could feel that too. One must be very, very alert, he would say. And he cut through all the bull. You know, you said you can put a Coca-Cola bottle on the mantelpiece and just say Coca-Cola, 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 and you're having a religious experience? No, he says. You know. I thought, wow. There's something here. It wasn't until we accidentally went to Tassajara that I felt like I met it. Really met it. Still not understanding at all, but completely feeling something was there. Something that I needed to know about. I also, we went to Big Sur occasionally, my husband and I, for a weekend getaway to Deachin's, Big Sur Inn. And once when we were there, a group of people came in, and among them was a very tall, very handsome man. really beautiful in his features, and something in his face just shone in such a way that I thought, oh, there's something else there than I've ever seen before. I have no idea who that man was, but it led me to realize that there's something more for us, in us, by us, whatever, than I knew. So I think in one way we're very fortunate when we run into it. On the other hand, I think it's showing up in our lives all the time. And that we, even unintentionally, begin to cultivate our life in a certain way. It's a great good fortune to be born a human being, they say. And it's a great good fortune to be born a human being in a world where we're not trying to survive only. With sheer survival, it's very hard to practice. But once there's a little extra time, we can begin to hear something and see something. There's something more that's always with us, that's always happening. And yet, finding the traces and cultivating practice, at least in my experience in the early years at Haiku Zendo, I felt practicing with Koban as if I'd died and gone to heaven. It was all there. He was teaching. The people there were very interesting. Also working very hard, listening and watching and opening up. And yet there was something in me that also was digging in her heels like a six-year-old kid, saying, "You can't make me do this. You can't make me. I won't. I won't." I think that's part of the practice, too. It's what he calls, from the Rinzai point of view, the doubt. And that's a very important part of it as well. If there's no tension in our practice, if we just swallow it whole, it loses its authenticity, its reality. So he calls it excursions toward the unknown. We make excursions toward the unknown in fear and attraction, both. And maybe get a little taste and run back into our hole again. And then sniff, sniff, going out, trying. The biggest change for me came when sessions began. Just going once a week, I kept getting a taste of it, but when we sat for longer periods out in the ranch where we held sessions, it's what he reminds us is called Jōriki, the power that builds up inside us when we sit for long periods of time. It's our own power. It's our own vitality and strength and wisdom that grows up, builds up inside us. And it's very important for practice. Welcome home. And with that power of concentration, the concentration that comes not by trying to concentrate, but just by shikantaza, just by sitting itself, by offering ourselves, and offering ourselves especially to not knowing, to not controlling, to not cultivating our story, but simply allowing ourselves to be who we are and where we are on the spot, in the moment, moment by moment by moment. And when you get up in the morning and just sit down, and sit down through most of the day quietly, without any distractions to speak of, it's you become familiar, we become familiar with our breath, with our belly, with how the blood runs through us and the wind, how much a part of earth we are, how much a part of all things we are. It's hard to know when we feel so separate running around in the world. It's pretty easy to know if we're willing to sit. And then it gets tricky, or at least it was for me, because I was sitting at Haiku Zendo and going home and taking care of my family and going back and forth to Sesshin and seeing all the neighbors and their children, and baking bread for everybody and all the things that you do as a young mother. And I kept thinking, should I talk about this? Should I mention it? And I didn't for a long time. I didn't know what to say. And I think I was embarrassed also. When you're starting out, you feel kind of strange about it. I knew I didn't want to go to San Francisco Zen Center and walk around like this in a long robe, that I knew I was going to stay home with my children. But I had a sense that maybe it wasn't proper to talk about in the context that I was in. But little by little it comes out anyway. It just does. And then, of course, I began to realize that everything was talking to me. That everybody around, that everyone was talking to me. That the practice was everywhere. It wasn't in the Zendo. Or it begins in the Zendo? Not even. It begins with when the sperm and the egg come together. I've been reading a new book about a discussion about Dogen's ideas. And the first chapter is about nirvana and samsara. And he's making it very clear. It's all so much of it a struggle to find the right words for what is untalkaboutable. And he emphasizes that it isn't that nirvana is a part of samsara, or that nirvana and samsara belong together or intertwine with each other. It's like form and emptiness. Nirvana is samsara. Samsara is nirvana. And this life that we live, moment by moment, is the life, both of sentient being, stumbling, foolish, hard-working, sentient being, and Buddha itself. Daido says that this one, this cultivating practice, and is especially in those early years, takes a lot of patience, because we get tastes and glimpses, and some boredom, pain, discouragement. It's not easy, but it's so interesting. And more than interesting, it informs our life. We begin to realize the light that we are, what shines even in the dark and the foolishness and confusion. Something is shining. So I don't know whether you all are reading this, or yeah, probably not, are you? Donna Lynn is reading it, but I guess that's all. Oh, Wendy has it. Cool. Lauren has it. All right. So I think that covers the second one somewhat. Do you have questions? Comments? Lauren?
Something you said about form and emptiness and samsara and nirvana. Something struck me when I was reading this, and that's, you know, if someone had asked me, and this has come up numerous times, I've given people copies of something, the Oxford Indigenous, mm-hmm. to look at when I thought that they were struggling with certain things in their life. And if you had asked me, what does the ox represent? I would have said, using terms that Dan has taught me occur in Zen mind, beginner's mind, I would have said it represents the monkey mind.
Oh. And
because, you know, you're trying to tame the ox. And of course, Lurie says exactly the opposite.
Yes.
That it's, someone's going to have to remind me of the right term for it, the way he says it. But, you know, he says that it's your true self,
yes,
that you're in search of. Hmm? So and like you're saying, it's both at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. Feel like the monkey mind is something that really have to get control over, and yet that itself is what it is. Yeah. Samia?
Did you ever question your teacher,
You mean what he did or what he said?
Or, you know,
later on I did. Not in the beginning. Not at all.
And did it later, did you think that you almost didn't need to do it? Or was it important that you did?
Question him?
Right.
Oh, it was important. It was complicated. We had a misunderstanding, a very basic and huge misunderstanding that fortunately we straightened out before he died. It would have been awful if he'd gone before we had gotten it cleared up. Otherwise, I supported him in every way I could, even though I thought sometimes he was making a mistake. You know, especially in terms of romance, you could say, I think he didn't have much sense when it came to women and love, or at least he didn't know how to manage it very well. He often wanted to give people advice about, you know, relationships, and it always was a mistake when he did. So in that sense, I did not agree with everything that he said or did. But in terms of the Dharma, I did. I just gave myself over to it completely.
But misunderstanding is part of life, so it's kind of important to deal with it.
Yes.
So maybe we can apply it to any misunderstanding, perhaps, then one should confront it.
And work with it, of course. A
so
friend.
Would you have done it differently if you were to do it again, as far as...
If I had known now what I know now, I wouldn't have suggested what I had. I suggested that instead of being both the director and this teacher in the Zendo at Jikoji, that I give up the directorship, at which I was not doing a very good job in the first place, and which I couldn't deal with anymore, and just take care of the Zendo part of it, because he was living in New Mexico. So I would take care of it as I had been doing for the last 8 or 9 years. He would say he would come for Sesshin, and sometimes he would and sometimes he wouldn't. And when he didn't, I was the instead of Koban person, and I did the Sesshin and was the teacher. But a substitute teacher. And I always felt I was holding the space for him. But when I asked to get that position authorized by him, he was very angry. Very angry. The position of being the substitute teacher in the Zendo. I wanted him to authorize that and say...
showing up, so...
Yes, that's what I thought. And I was willing, I was saying, I'm willing to keep on holding this space for you. You know, I thought I was just giving him something. And he thought I was taking it. He thought, and he was correct in a way. In a way, it was correct, because when you sit with people, you just automatically begin to make connections and have a relationship. And I didn't understand that. But he knew that if I was settled there, and it was, you know, he said that, then people would feel free to make that connection, and his whole connection with it would have been gone. So, he obviously didn't want that to happen. But he didn't tell me that. He
but
thought...
Is that an insecurity on the side? Or?
Sure. Okay. Sure. He was insecure. No, he was trying to keep the whole thing afloat and free-flowing. which is really hard to do. And and to keep his life afloat and free-flowing at the same time. And it was very complicated. So he depended on us in many ways just to keep things going, keep it all intact and create a place for him from which he could teach. But at the same time, he didn't want to relinquish it to us, or at least to me, and I was too young to be having it turned over to me. too young in the practice. You don't become an abbot, you know, after practicing a few years. It's for really advanced students to do that job. So there were some years when I would show up for something and he would be doing it and he'd turn his back on me. It was really painful because I didn't know what it was. And it took a while to figure it out. But we did. We did. I just kept doing this kind of thing and telling him what I was doing. I would write to him and send him photographs and tell him who had taken the precepts and what their new names were. And I kept waiting for him to call me up and say, "Stop it." But he didn't. He didn't at all.
So you started your own group.
I started my own group. And eventually, he came back and gave some classes in Santa Cruz. And during those classes, he asked what he could do to help me and began helping me in a lot of different ways, you know, really encouraging me. So he kicked me out in a way and made me... the last thing he said to me when I had to leave Jikoji was, "A teacher appears when students appear." So he was saying, don't set yourself up and try to be a teacher. You can't do it, and it's not authentic. That from the student side, you know, the teacher appears. But from the teacher side, students appear. And then the teacher becomes a real student. So, because the students are the teachers. But unless you become truly embedded in a situation like that, a dynamic situation like that, then teaching and learning aren't happening. Or whatever this, I mean, it's not even teaching and learning, it's something else. Some kind of life that happens between, within all of us.
Do you think it had to do because you were a woman versus a man, just because of where he's from?
Partly, though he was very generous with women and encouraged us. No, I wasn't the only one that he encouraged. But I think he didn't quite know what to do with us also. He didn't quite know what we could do. And I think he had his doubts. So it was up, he always said, "It's up to you. It's all up to you," he would say. I'd think, "Oh my God, what does that mean?" It meant a lot of work trying to figure out what this is and how to do. And of course, none of us knew. We were all just kind of going with it. What?
For historicity, we should, and to show how complex it is, we should set this beside what happened to Les.
Uh-huh.
Which is a situation in which, I mean, the sense I have from what Sharon is from, Copen wanted to distance himself from that. And at one point he took his hoshu and gave it to Les and said, "Here, this is yours now."
Yes. That was a very complicated situation. Because Les really wanted to transmit with Copen and started training with Copen, and Copen said yes. and then would make dates with Les, and Les would go and knock on the door and nobody would be home. And he got stood up a number of times, so he finally said, well, to heck with it, I'm not going to go with Koban, I'm going to go with Suzuki Roshi's son. So as soon as he did that, that's when Koban gave him the hosha. And by that time, Les said, no, I don't want it. You know, I'm not doing this. So he did go with Suzuki Roshi. There were, what, five guys who went to Japan. Bill Kwong, Les, Mel, Reb, somebody else, I think. But that was another... It's tricky. It's all very tricky. And it's very intuitive.